It's time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cyclists, trails, travel, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. You can subscribe to our weekly podcast at OutspokenCyclist.com or through your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for September 25th, 2021. It's hard to believe that September is already over, but now all that great fall riding season is coming up. Many folks think this is absolutely the best riding season of the year. I have two great guests on two very diverse topics for you this week. The transportation bill needs to be reauthorized. September 30th is the deadline. That fact led me to Noa Banyan. She's the Director of Federal Affairs for People for Bikes. Noa is headquartered in Washington, D.C., and is the liaison between government and us when it comes to support and funding of programs that will impact bicycling on so many levels. And she knows her stuff. Noa will be with me in a moment. After our mid-show break, we'll meet Carl Gady. He and his wife, Julie, are both psychotherapists, and when they learned about a situation in Uganda in 2008, they literally sold all their belongings, packed their bags, and decided to take their special wellness program to the refugees who were finding themselves mentally and emotionally stressed from the war and the torture. Since then, their nonprofit organization, Tutupona, has helped tens of thousands of refugees with stress-related problems. But what does this have to do with bicycles? You'll see. Carl will be with me later in the show. Between the transportation and reconciliation bills, there is potentially a huge pot of money on the table for us. Noa Banyan, the Director of Federal Affairs for People for Bikes, breaks it down. Hi, Noa. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Yeah, People for Bikes. We talk to people at the organization all the time. Mm-hmm. And something came up this week about the markup of the bill in Congress. Actually, it was from last week. You know, I'm waiting for this transportation bill to actually go somewhere. But I wanted to talk about some things that have to do with the bill, and especially that e-bike portion. Before we do that, tell us your role at People for Bikes, Director of Federal Affairs. What does that mean?
Sure. Yeah, it's a great question. So I am based in Washington, D.C. With People for Bikes, which is a Boulder, Colorado-based organization. And my role here in D.C. is to really help extend the voice of the bicycle industry to the policy space and open up those channels of advocacy for the bicycle industry to policymakers, regulators, their staff, the administration, you know, anyone in and around the federal policy system. I sort of look at myself as the conduit between the bike industry, our advocates, everything that we want to see happen through policy, and then just making that access possible by having someone on the ground here.
Are you the only person in DC?
That is correct. We do have a lot of partners and consultants here in DC that I work closely with, but I am the DC HQ of People for Bikes.
That's pretty cool. I like that. So have you always been in DC?
I have been here for 7 years now, but grew up in New England.
Ah, okay. Very cool. So let's talk about this sort of elusive transportation bill. And I know somebody asked, I think it was probably the LAB had an ask, you know, get in touch with your legislators, talk to them about the e-bike tax credit. And something happened recently that the $1,500 maybe is going to be cut in half if it ever comes up at all. So tell us what's going on with the federal government, the transportation bill, and what you see for bicycles that is positive.
Sure. Yeah, there's so many moving parts right now in Washington, D.C., and there's not a hugely clear path forward for any of them at this moment. But I think we'll see a lot of updates and action in the coming weeks as lawmakers start to hit deadlines for certain bills and policies and funding. But before we get into, you know, everything going on, I want to help clarify a bit for listeners these sort of two separate processes that are really taking up a lot of the policy bandwidth. And you mentioned the transportation bill. That's one of them, basically. The transportation bill is what we talk about when we talk about the funding that goes to the Department of Transportation and all of the programs they manage to work with state DOTs, fund their, you know, programs and building and maintenance. And of course, when we're talking about bicycle infrastructure, the transportation bill is our largest opportunity to expand that pot. But the transportation bill itself is actually nestled into this larger infrastructure bill, this bipartisan infrastructure bill, you've maybe heard it called.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
It's sort of a misnomer.
It's the transportation bill inside the bipartisan infrastructure bill. And so that's sort of one main track or process that's happening right now. The Senate approved the bipartisan infrastructure bill. They sent it to the House, and now the House has to decide when they will be voting on it to send to President Biden's desk to sign into law. That question of when is just mired in politics right now, and we definitely don't need to get into that. But just know that there's transportation inside of infrastructure, and that's sort of one parallel track. The other one that we're talking about, especially when we talk about these e-bike programs and incentives, the tax credit, that's part of a separate legislative process. I'm sure many of your listeners have heard the term reconciliation or budget reconciliation, and that's a bit different. So it's a different policy, a different package, a different process, and we can get into some of those differences, but I do want to talk a little bit about the transportation bill first before we dig into some of the e-bike stuff and the reconciliation bill.
Well, let me just take a moment to reintroduce you, and then we will move on to that. And I like the way you're breaking it down. I think that makes a lot of sense. We're speaking with, I'm going to try and get this right, Noah Banayan?
Yeah,
Banayan. Banayan. I got to get that right. Tell me what that is. What is the origin of that name? It's so pretty.
Oh, thank you. It goes way back to Armenia, but that's many generations ago in my family.
We just had a big Armenian festival right here in Cleveland.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, we have this really cool thing that along something called, everybody has a Martin Luther King Drive, right? The Rockefellers built these beautiful gardens, and there's the Armenian garden, and there's the Italian garden, and the Syrian garden, and they had a huge festival. That's really, really cool. Okay, moving on. So we were talking about the two different processes. One is the infrastructure bill, under which there's the transportation bill, and then the reconciliation situation, which is different. And you wanted to start back with transportation.
Yeah, and we can just touch on that briefly on the e-bike stuff. But so the transportation bill is this sort of monumental, every 5-6 years, we get an opportunity to reauthorize this funding. And the funding is actually set to expire on September 30th. So that's why there's so much noise right now about what the House is going to do about this infrastructure bill, partially because of that transportation funding deadline. But within the transportation bill, there are programs like the Transportation Alternatives Program, which is the largest source of federal funding for bike infrastructure. As written right now, that gets a really significant plus up in the transportation bill. It goes from $850 million a year to $1.2 billion in the first year, so in 2022, which is hugely significant and I think a really great marker of how we're looking at bicycle infrastructure investments to support the huge growth in ridership that we're seeing across the country.
What do you think the possibility is that actually will stay in the bill and pass?
I think so. I think that part is really solid, and I don't necessarily see that. It doesn't seem like the House will be doing or making any significant changes to the transportation bill and the infrastructure bill that we've already seen pass the Senate. So that's in there. But I will say the transportation bill itself does miss the mark on a couple other pieces that are sort of just ongoing issues that we're looking for ways to address in DC. But namely, it does not increase funding for the recreational trails program, which has been woefully underfunded for at least a decade now. And funding hasn't been increased for that amount of time. So that's something that we feel really is missed in that opportunity, is to increase funding. We've seen how vital trails are for communities across the country. And of course, the name of the program is Recreational Trails, and recreation itself is a vital part of economic growth and public health and community development. And of course, the climate crisis too. But trails are also the way that we connect, you know, transportation networks. They're the spines that put, you know, connect cities and regions together through active transportation. So funding for recreational trails is really critical across transportation and recreation.
Go ahead. I was going to ask if there's another source of funding for recreational trails outside of the fact that they've been left out of the transportation bill.
So for that specific program, there isn't another source. It's not that they've necessarily been left out of the bill. They just have kept the funding at a status quo level.
Okay.
But there are other opportunities throughout the year to address this issue of this lack of increase in funding. You know, we are working on closely with our partners to identify and strategize around.
Okay.
And the last part too about the transportation bill is that while it includes the title of a new program that we're really excited about, it does not include funding for this program, which is the Active Transportation Connectivity Grant Program, the goal of which is to fund the connections between different pieces of bike infrastructure and walking infrastructure to create actual, safe, accessible networks. And unfortunately, there was not any funding included for that program in the transportation bill.
So let me ask a question about, I'm an advisory board member for the East Coast Greenway.
Oh, great.
And there was some talk that there was going to be, $3.4 billion available, perhaps. And I mean, this is the big picture of maybe for this kind of funding. And now you're kind of dashing my hopes here.
So that's we still have to get into reconciliation.
Oh, okay.
It's a little bit, but I do. So I'll say that the way that we would describe the bipartisan infrastructure bill is it does increase funding for bike infrastructure in a lot of ways. And that's great. It's critical. It's necessary. But sticking with the status quo of how we've chosen to fund bike infrastructure at such a small percentage of the overall transportation package is not going to meet the moment that we're in right now, which is new riders across the country, people returning to bike riding across the country. It's bike shops being sold out and trails ultimately being really crowded, bike paths being crowded. The moment we have right now is this uniquely wild demand for safe, connected places to bike. And this bill just doesn't quite get there. But we have this other opportunity, reconciliation, that does do a few things, or could do a few things if it is passed in the way that we've seen it written now. That would be pretty transformational.
Let's take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about this part of the reconciliation bill. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. The Outspoken Cyclist is proud to have Bike Law as a trusted partner. If you find yourself in need of legal advice or assistance as it pertains to any cycling issue, log on to bikelaw.com. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. It just started pouring here in Northeast Ohio. We were expecting this. We're speaking with Noah Banyan, from People for Bikes. She is the Director of Federal Affairs and clearly knows her stuff. We were talking about the transportation bill. Now we're going to talk about the reconciliation bill that probably holds some more hope for us in cycling.
Sure. Thanks, Diane. So the reconciliation bill, and please hold me back if this gets too wonky at any point, but we've all heard about reconciliation at this point in the news. And before I just dig into the bike stuff included in it, it's separate from the infrastructure package because it's going through a partisan process. You know, the infrastructure package is called the bipartisan infrastructure bill. It was drafted with Democrats and Republicans at the table, but reconciliation is going through a strictly Democrats only track. And it's sort of meeting all of those pieces that I think a lot of folks in the Democratic Party wanted in the infrastructure bill, but would not have been able to get through on a bipartisan basis. A lot of this reconciliation bill is trying to meet the demands of the Biden agenda for things beyond, you know, hard infrastructure. It's, of course, it's another political process, and there's a lot of politics involved into when we're going to see this vote and how it relates to transportation. But let's get into the bike stuff, because that's really what we're excited about.
Right.
So the reconciliation bill, I think we could break this down into two pieces of what's exciting for bikes. There's these tax provisions. We're going to make tax policy exciting. And then there's some more infrastructure opportunities as well. Let me start briefly with infrastructure, since that's the track we were on, and then we can close out with a bang on the tax stuff, because I think that's pretty flashy stuff. The infrastructure side, the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee in the House recently passed their portion of this broader reconciliation bill that included some significant funding for programs to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and fund bicycle active transportation infrastructure grants focused on connectivity. So that looks very similar to what we've been working on and what I was talking about before with active transportation connectivity grants. So there's a significant pot of funding for that, which is really exciting to see written into reconciliation. And the greenhouse gas emissions program is also a sort of new and creative approach to leveraging bike infrastructure as a tool for reducing emissions, because we know that when we Americans, anyone has safe places to ride a bike, you're more likely to go on your bike and to use that infrastructure and therefore potentially replace a car trip. And ultimately, that's the message we're pushing from the bike perspective, is when you make it easier and safer to choose going by bike, you make it easier and safer to leave the car at home. And that's going to be really significant in fighting the climate crisis.
How much money are we talking about in the infrastructure part of the reconciliation bill?
Right. So the greenhouse gas emissions program is about, I think it's a $4 billion program. $3 billion. Apologies. So $3 billion for the community climate incentive grants and the connectivity program, which they're calling the neighborhood access and equity grants, gets $4 billion.
Whoa, that's a big number when you add them together.
It's significant. Yeah. And I will say these aren't, you know, dedicated to only bike infrastructure. There's other things that are included as eligible costs and projects, which is all good and fine. So I wouldn't add them up and say that much money exactly going to bikes, but it's you can certainly make some connections there.
So would this funding, however it sort of parses out, begin to trickle down to states, or are states going to apply for these funds or localities? How will these funds be distributed? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think there's some differences between the programs, and within the programs, they offer some differences between, you know, this much directly to states or this much specifically for grants that communities can apply for without necessarily going through the state or MPO process. So there's some technicalities and nuances there, but yes, ideally this is money that would be easily accessible to the folks in charge of projects that need it.
That's a good thing. That's a good thing. Okay. I have an end question to all of this, of course. So then let's go back to the tax stuff. Excuse me. Let's go back to the tax provisions part of the reconciliation bill.
Sure. So the this other part, you've seen probably a lot of articles about this, is in the tax portion of the reconciliation bill that was passed in the House Ways and Means Committee last week. That's the tax committee. You will find a tax credit for purchasing electric bicycles, a commuter benefit for biking to work, tax benefits for businesses that want to install electric bicycle and micro-mobility charging stations. So, you know, tax policy might sound a little esoteric, but when you start thinking about ways that you can leverage the tax code to support and incentivize bicycling, we get really excited. And the House Ways and Means Committee has done a really great job of including these programs in their bill, given that there are, you know, a million different priorities circling around electric vehicles and things like that. But let me talk about the electric bicycle tax credit, because I think that's one of your main questions of, you know, what's changed with that? How have we been tracking it? What's the future look like for it? And so when I say electric bicycle tax credit, what I mean is, if this bill were to pass, we, the American taxpayers, when we go to file our taxes, if we had bought an electric bicycle that year that qualifies for this tax credit, we could put that down in our taxes and get a credit on it, a tax credit. That's a real simple way of putting it. And the idea being, this will incentivize more Americans to choose electric bicycles as a form of transportation, reducing the burden of the cost of car ownership for a lot of American families, because that's huge. It can be $8,000 to $9,000 a year to manage a car, and an electric bicycle, you know, on average, can cost between $2,000 to $4,000, and it doesn't need gas or insurance in most places,
right?
Or parking costs necessarily. But the details of the tax credit did shift a bit. If folks that are listening have been following along with this policy, you're familiar with the E-Bike Act, which was the bill that was introduced in the House back in February, and put this as a 30% refundable tax credit up to $1,500 on the purchase of a qualifying new electric bicycle. And it didn't include any like income phase out restrictions, things like that. But when the committee was working on this bill and, you know, trying to fit all of these really exciting new programs within the cost confines that they were given, you know, they have to keep all these things that they're going to spend money on to under a certain amount. The tax credit was one of the policies, one of many that had to get adjusted a little bit to fit within that confine so it could stay on the table. And so what this bill that is being called the Build Back Better Act includes is a 15% refundable tax credit available to American taxpayers who make under $75,000 a year. So they're really targeting this to low-income folks. And they did shrink the amount of the credit a little bit, but again, like, getting a credit on the table is huge. And the way that reconciliation works is over a 10-year time frame. So the overall investment proposed by this tax credit over 10 years is $7.4 billion.
Wow.
From the federal government. They anticipate this costing $7.4 billion over 10 years. So that's how much that they're willing to invest in electric bicycle incentives, which is a massive number. I mean, that's transformational.
That brings up a question for me about the e-bike itself.
Yeah.
So e-bikes can range in price from probably around $1,200 up to about $8,000. They're pretty expensive when you get into the, you know, the high-end bikes.
Or cargo bikes.
And cargo bikes, exactly. And that was going to be one of my questions, is it has to be an e-bike. But I look at some of the bikes today, being in the bicycle business, and people are spending huge amounts of money on bicycles. Of course, they also can afford it. and there are no tax credits there.
Yeah.
You know, and if they're using them for commuting, of course, somebody who buys an e-bike may not use it for commuting. They may just use it to do what they're doing now, which is recreational riding. Mm-hmm. So my question really comes down to, maybe it's just a philosophical difference, but a bike is a bike is a bike, and an e-bike is a pedal assist. It's not really a motorcycle per se.
No.
Yeah. So I'm just wondering why they stopped at e-bikes as opposed to like saying, if you get a bicycle and you start riding it for XYZ, we're going to offer you, you know, an incentive for that. Let's take another short break. And when we come back, we'll let Noah answer that question. Why just e-bikes? You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We are back. I'm Diane Jenks. Before the break, I asked Noah why all the focus in the commuter piece of the reconciliation bill was on e-bikes, not just bikes in general. Let's hear her answer.
I think that's such a valid question. And, you know, People for Bikes has always championed all bicycles as a, you know, superior mode of transportation for so many things. And so I just want to make sure that's very clear to your listeners. Like, we would love that policy. But everything is a negotiation when it comes to getting something passed in DC. And so it sort of starts with that, but also electric bicycles are on average more expensive than regular bicycles because of that technology. So what the tax credit does is helps to level the playing field a bit. And if you think about, you know, the physical ability that's needed to use a bicycle for transportation, of course, so many of us in the bike industry are able to say, yeah, we can bike to work, no problem. Like, this is easy. We love it. We don't mind showing up a bit sweaty, you know, all of that. But that's not the case for, I think, most Americans, you could probably argue. And so adding that small pedal assist boost to bicycling expands the activity of bicycling to so many people. And that is just something so unique to electric bicycles that was really part of the intent of this tax credit, especially looking at electric cargo bicycles, like I mentioned, where you're really getting that sort of trunk capacity that you would get in a car, your ability to throw something in your back Fiat or your back basket. Those tend to add up in cost because you're adding more to the bicycle. And those are the real, you know, car replacement devices that we're seeing through market data and through anecdotes just from across the country. So, of course, a tax credit for all bicycles would be very cool. And so would having protected bike lanes on every street across
the country.
True. Yeah, right. If we're going to start big with our goals, I think that's a fantastic place to start. But of course, it's DC and everything is compromise and negotiation and figuring out what's not even negotiation, but what's the most likely to have success at this moment. And given the rise in popularity of e-bikes, so many more Americans and their elected officials realizing the utility and potential of this device, that's what was really stuck for this tax credit policy when Congressman Panetta and Blumenauer started thinking about it.
Right. Well, I've had Congressman Blumenauer on the show, and I know, you know, we used to go to the bike summit, and he always had his little bicycle pin. Let me remind listeners once again, we are speaking with Noah Banayan, and she is the Director of Federal Affairs for People for Bikes. Great conversation, by the way. So I guess a place that cyclists can get some relief, whether they have an e-bike or not, is this commuter credit.
Right.
Okay. Yes. Let's talk about that a little bit.
This is one I don't see it getting as much pickup in the news, but it's really an impressive program that, if passed, could give commuters, bike commuters, access to $1,000, nearly $1,000 pre-tax for biking to work. The commuter benefit was suspended in 2017. And so right now, if you bike to work, you're not getting anything for it.
Right.
In the same way that you are for, you know, a lot of parking benefits or transit benefits.
It also, as I remember, prior to 2017, had a lot of restrictions. It had to go through the bike shop and you had to show receipts, and it was really for repairs, if I'm not mistaken.
It was different. It was a reimbursement. So you had to show receipts, and I think it was $20 a month. But this one, as written in the Build Back Better Act or the Bicycle Commuter Act, would be $81 a month pre-tax that you can access as a commuter for costs related to your bicycle, for bike share, electric bicycle. And I think I actually expanded it to just micromobility broadly. So there's a lot of flexibility in the benefit as written. You do not have to ride your bike to work every day to be able to access it, which is important. You could use it alongside parking and transit benefits, understanding that most folks probably don't bike to work every single day, or maybe they bike to a transit stop, or they carpool some other days. So that was written into the bill to give it that much flexibility. And like I said, $81 a month pre-tax, that's almost $1,000 a year that you can access to support yourself biking to work.
It's just phenomenal how things have, I mean, I look back on the, you know, almost 45 years that I've been in the bike business, and things seem to be accelerating a little bit, which makes me feel really good. I'm seeing projects that got started getting done. I'm seeing these kinds of opportunities for e-bike and commuter credits actually being written. But of course, here's the big question. What is the possibility? Because as I understand the reconciliation bill, along with the infrastructure bill, the House wants to see them voted on at the same time. If I'm not mistaken, they want it all to happen at once. And somehow it's being held up because of that. What is the possibility that this stuff is actually going to really happen?
If I knew the answer.
They pay you even more money, right?
I might have a different job if I knew the answer. It's really tough to say right now, and that's for a lot of reasons, but the politics around it are just blowing up and changing every day. And so when we say the House wants one thing, I mean, the House wants a million things. And then the Democratic Party within the House also wants several different things and sometimes competing outcomes. So it's difficult to say. It really does seem like the success of one package is dependent on the success of the other. But which one will come first is to be determined.
So I guess the last thing I'd like to know is, what kind of influence, if any, mm-hmm. can listeners have? Can the people who hear this show every week, and a lot of them will take action if asked to do that. What kind of influence can we have in getting these really pro-bike programs happening?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. And I would love to use the combined power of your listeners to help keep them moving. So the, you know, number one thing you can do is reach out to your member of Congress and your senators and tell them that you, a constituent, wholeheartedly support these programs, and they should too. And People for Bikes has made that pretty easy with a couple of different action alerts that hopefully we can share with you, Diane, and you can share with your listeners, that make it really, really simple to send a letter to your member of Congress and senators.
Perfect. Okay.
And especially if you live in a state like Oregon, where, oh, I don't know, your Senator Ron Wyden is the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee and has a lot of sway over what tax policies move in the Senate, that would be a really great place to show your support, especially. If you live in any state with a senator on the Finance Committee, that's a good place to start.
Yeah, I don't know if Sherrod Brown is on the Finance Committee.
We can certainly double check. He is.
Yeah, and I thought so. Yeah, I was thinking, Sherrod Brown is on. Yeah, okay. And reach out, Ohioans. Well, that's where we are. That's just, or where I am. I mean, my listeners are everywhere. So, okay, what else can we do?
Yeah, well, Sherrod Brown is a great example. He hasn't explicitly shown support for the e-bike tax credit, but he is one of the lead sponsors of the bicycle commuter benefit in the Senate.
Interesting.
So tying those two policies together and showing how the two policies will really work together to support bicycling and people who want to bike and lower their emissions and you know, reduce congestion, all of these good things we all stand to benefit from. I think tying those two policy stories together is a really great narrative.
Oh, I'm specifically writing this down because Sherrod Brown's been on my show. It's been a long time, but now I have something else I want to talk to him about. Let's get the e-bike in there as well as the commuter credit. And so what else can we do besides get on to People for Bikes? It's peopleforbikes.org. We will have that link everywhere, including on the blog that houses this, the link to the show. So are there other things we can do?
I think showing your support for these policies on social media, showing your support for the broader reconciliation package as an opportunity to advance climate policy and equity and things like that is a really good message right now, because the fate of reconciliation is really up in the air. And as advocates for bicycling, it's just so critical that these policies move forward in this package.
All right. Well, I think we can do that. I mean, I can certainly suggest it and I can certainly do it myself. And I have every reason to believe that if the voice, you know, if just the bike shops themselves would put a little bit of effort in for their, for themselves and their clients, it would make me really, really happy. But I often see that the bicycle industry as a whole is so scattered and People for Bikes has been a way to sort of pull it for, together. It's one of the only organizations over the many years I've been in the business that seems to be getting stronger and more cohesive as opposed to weaker and more, you know, falling apart. So it's good to see that they have you in Washington and that they have the big organization in Colorado. So I really appreciate that you're doing the work you're doing.
Thank you, Diane. I really, it's nice to hear that. Yeah, we've got a great, you know, slate of partners nationally, locally that that help us advance this message and the work, and of course advocates and media folks like you that are really helping. So we're grateful for this broader network of bicycle advocacy and educators, you know, helping spread the word.
We've been speaking with Noah Banyan from People for Bikes. She's the director of federal affairs. Her ask and my ask is that you go to peopleforbikes.org and contact your legislator on the issues we've been talking about. Use your Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and talk about the commuter tax credit, talk about the e-bike credit, and let's see if we can't get this reconciliation bill nailed down. Thank you so much for talking with me. It's been a fascinating conversation and I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you, Diane. This has been a pleasure.
My thanks to Noah Banyan for joining me today. If you're ready to take action on behalf of the bicycling pieces of the transportation and reconciliation bills, you can go to peopleforbikes.org and click on the advocacy tab at the top of the page. Let's take another short break and we'll be right back to speak with Carl Gady, founder of Tutapona. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks. We've been talking about the refugee situation in Afghanistan for the past several weeks, and we will give you a brief update at the end of the show. There are other refugee stories, though, stories that we occasionally hear about, but that somehow seem really far away. The way we address those stories is to make donations or send clothing and food, and those things are really important. But what is equally important and what we don't talk about is the stress that these people are experiencing and what can be done about it. Back in 2008, Carl and Julia Gady learned of the Acholi people who live in Sudan and northern Uganda. They were under threat and torture from the LRA, the Lord's Resistance Army, and their story became the passion of the Gadys. Out of the horrors that the Acholi people were experiencing, Carl and Julie founded Tutapona, a Swahili word meaning we will be healed. And that is what the Gaties have been doing ever since. Hi, Carl. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for being my guest today. How are you?
Hi, Diane. It's great to be here. I'm doing fantastic.
So you said you were somewhere in quote unquote rural Wisconsin. What's rural Wisconsin? Where?
We're actually on the far western side of Wisconsin, right near the Minnesota border. So we're actually not too far from Minneapolis-St. Paul. We're about an hour east of the Twin Cities into Wisconsin.
Nice.
Yeah.
Is it nice there? It is pouring.
It is.
Here. Oh, yeah.
I'm hoping. It's nice here. And we have a lot of really nice cycling, just some kind of farmlands and a lot of rural roads where you can get away from cars and traffic and some, you know, pretty nice scenery. And so, yeah, this is a good place to ride and it's a good place to live. There's a lot of great people here.
Well, you know, we're watching the migration of refugees and whether they're coming to the U.S. for asylum from South America through Mexico or those in Afghanistan and China and Syria, other places. You're part of an organization that's raising awareness for displaced people around the world. And I thought that that was a really interesting place to be as far as there are so many sort of disparate groups. So I've been working with a group to get Afghan cyclists out of Afghanistan, women. And I know people are working to get Syrian people into a refugee situation. But I'd like to know about your organization, Tutapona.
Yeah, that's right. So Tutapona was founded in 2008 by my wife and I, really in response to a situation that was occurring in Uganda, East Africa, with a rebel group known as the LRA or Lord's Resistance Army. My wife and I are trained psychotherapists. We were working as psychotherapists here in Wisconsin. And then we heard about this situation in northern Uganda and the way that the Acholi people were being traumatized and impacted in the most horrific ways by this rebel group. And we just knew we had to do something about it. And so in 2008, we sold everything and moved to Uganda to start a program of trauma rehabilitation, really just taking the only thing that we had, the only thing that we knew how to do, and that was counseling and working to address the emotional effects of armed conflict. There were a lot of great organizations that were there doing things, providing assistance, but nobody was really addressing the emotional effects of the war. So that's what we were able to start doing. So really Tutapona exists. By the way, Tutapona is a Swahili word because Swahili is a unifying language around Central and East Africa, and it means we will be healed. So it's this idea that healing is a community effort. It's not an individual pursuit. It's a we. And it's this idea that it's future tense, that even if today is terrible and awful, that tomorrow will be better than today.
That's wonderful. Are you the only organization that you know about that works on this level with the emotional and psychological effects that these kinds of armed conflicts inflict?
Well, back in those days, we were one of the very, very few that we knew of. Now there are more organizations that are focusing on what they call mental health or psychosocial support. Large groups like World Vision, Samaritan's Purse, Save the Children, War Child Holland, that work specifically with child soldiers and trying to bring mental health support. But we're the only ones that I know of that are exclusively focused on only addressing the emotional effects. We don't do other things. We don't do food distribution or education or medical. We just do this one thing, and we really strive to be experts at doing this one thing really well. And to answer your question about why Uganda, you know, at that point in history, it felt like that was the epicenter of trauma. The Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs at the UN, a man named Jan Egeland, was reporting that this is the world's worst unattended humanitarian crisis on the planet. And there was just something about this and the use of child soldiers in this conflict and the way the child soldiers were treated and the horrific nature of what was happening that my wife and I just knew we had to do something. And now that we knew about it, we had a responsibility to do something. We couldn't just go back to life as normal, and we couldn't just bury our heads in the sand and pretend that we didn't know this information now. So that was really the catalyst to start. And then since then, we've expanded. We still have teams working in Uganda, and then we grew and expanded to, we have a team in Iraq working with Iraqis that were displaced because of ISIS, and working with Syrian refugees that are coming into Kurdistan, northern Iraq as well.
So let me take a moment to remind listeners that I'm speaking with Carl Gady. He is the founder of Tuta Pona. It's Swahili for We Will Be Healed. What an interesting story. I mean, you sent me this information about this ride, and we will eventually get to this ride. But I find the fact that I've been really immersed in this, trying to get these cyclists out of Afghanistan with another woman who is very, very involved with the Afghan situation. So I'm wondering what the incidence, and this is really a hard question, what the incidence is every time there is a crisis like this, Iraq, Syria, China, we have the Uyghurs, and now we have Afghanistan. At one point we had Kuwait. What happens to these people, and how many can you possibly help there? We're talking tens of thousands of people.
Yeah, that's right. And that's one of the reasons for this ride that we will talk about, apparently, as well, as to help bring awareness about this global refugee crisis. I think many people just aren't even aware the scale of this crisis and what's taking place and the emotional impact that this has, war, armed conflict, violence has on the people that are affected by it. So we're excited to bring awareness. We're excited to raise funds for the work that's taking place. But you're right, this is a problem all over the world. I just got back from Colombia, where we're exploring, can we work with Venezuelan refugees that are flooding into Colombia? I found out this is the worst refugee crisis in Latin American history. And largely it's going under the radar. Very few people really even know about it. But millions of Venezuelan refugees have been flooding into Colombia. We have looked at Afghanistan, Pakistan area, and Myanmar. I was in Bangladesh looking at working with refugees from Myanmar. So there's problems all over. One of the things that we're looking at is how can we set up teams in different locations like this around the world where there's a need. But also, in addition to that, how can we resource and train and equip other organizations to be able to do this in locations where we just simply can't open an office?
So what would that take? How many people would do you put together for a quote-unquote team? And what kind of training do they need? And what kind of education do they need?
Right. So we do a community-based program. It's really peer-led. So as you can imagine, myself being a white American male, I can't do the trauma counseling in another culture, in another language, with another people group. And so we learned very quickly that the best thing we can do is train and equip a team of local indigenous staff who can then facilitate these programs in their own language, in their own culture, with their own people. And if we have a program that is evidence-based, that we know works, and we train up our facilitators to facilitate this program, that it works really well. Now we have years and years of data to show how effective it is, that there's an over 50% reduction in post-traumatic stress symptoms among our participants. To date, we've served over 50,000 people, have gone through our programs in Africa and the Middle East. And through partnerships with other organizations, I think that number will continue to exponentially grow as we're in more places, working through more organizations and impacting more people. So we're super excited about that. But really, it is a process of trying to scale this up in a way that is sustainable and allows us to continue to do the great work in the locations where we are and then grow that as well.
So, you know what? Let's take a short break. And when we come back, we really will talk about the ride. We're speaking with Carl Gady about refugees and their needs and their mental health, something we've never discussed before. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We'll be right back.
Children in poverty, each one unique, each one full of dreams. They're our hope, our future. They're the reason Children International exists. When the whole world changed, we developed new ways to reach children and families during these vulnerable times.
Tengo suficiente comida saludable.
Estoy sana y fuerte.
To learn more, go to children.org/help today.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks. I guess one of the big questions is how you're funding this and the ride that we're going to talk about, this ride for, and it's a number for refugees. We will give you ways to know about all of this and the Tutapona website. Tell us a little bit about funding and who helps to support the organization and then how this ride came about.
Yeah. So as a 501c3 nonprofit charitable organization here in the U.S., we are funded mostly from individual donors who believe in the work and want to contribute to it. We're funded by churches who partner with us in this work. And then over the last few years, we have been reaching out and getting more grants as well. And then we partner with organizations through a fee-for-service arrangement, so it allows us to bring in the mental health component. But most of our funding comes from individual donors and partners here in the U.S. that say, you know, I really believe in that work and I want to be part of that.
So, and not to pry at what this is, and you can absolutely say, I can't say that. What does it cost to put a team together and offer these services? And how long is somebody who comes into your, you know, servicing program, how long do they need to be there?
Yeah, those are great questions. You know, to a large extent, it's individualized. And so it's a bit different given the context, and we have to adapt it and contextualize it. For example, when we went to Iraq, that was certainly, the model looked a little bit different than it did in Uganda. But for the most part, we try to keep it similar. So as we compare data, we can compare apples to apples. One of the primary components of our program is a two-week group-based intervention. And so, you know, the question about how long does it take? Well, that's a two-week program. And then our staff will then do home visits after that 2 weeks and continue to follow up with the participants. And then we go back 3 months later and do a one-week follow-up to make sure people are doing okay, make sure they don't have any questions, to follow up and see how they're doing, and also to reiterate what they've gone through and refresh their knowledge about the program as well.
Once somebody gets through the program, 2 weeks, and then the home visits, and then the 3 months later, are you seeing the kinds of results? Well, apparently you are, because they're working. So what are the results? So somebody coming into the program is somehow traumatized. Somebody who's done is more able to live his or her life in a more peaceful manner, I would imagine.
Right. Yep. So we do a couple of different measurements. We try to not make it too invasive, but we do think it's important to track how people are doing from a pre-intervention standpoint, post-intervention, and then three-month follow-up. And we're really measuring two different things. One is, it's a standardized measurement tool called the SPTSS, the Signs of Post-Traumatic Stress Symptoms. And this is a validated instrument in the professional literature, and it really measures their level of symptomatology of post-traumatic stress. So what we're looking for is that going down, of course, from a pre-intervention to post-intervention measurements. And then the second thing that we're measuring is we're measuring a well-being inventory, because we have a couple of different programs, but our newest program is really based around the literature in positive psychology and post-traumatic growth literature. So it's this idea that terrible, horrific, traumatic experiences can be a catalyst for growth in the person's life. And that's really what we want to see. And so we're measuring, it's called the post-traumatic growth inventory, PTGI. So we're really trying to measure their level of growth. Yeah, is that the best way to describe it?
Yeah, that's great. You know, that makes perfect sense to me. Well, I guess we really need to talk about this, right? Because it's starting really soon, and people can get involved in the ride by helping to donate. You have 8 riders going across the U.S. in 8 days on October 8th, right? And it's 3,200 miles. How's the ride going to unfold? Where does it start? Where does it end? And how will it work?
Yeah, that's right. It starts on October 2nd.
October 2nd. Of course, I got that wrong twice now. Okay.
Saturday, October 2nd. And really, this is an idea that was born out of my lifelong love of cycling and my love of Tutapona, and thinking for years now, is there a way that I could combine the two somehow? And I'm not the best fundraiser or marketing person at all. And so I had a difficult time figuring out how I could do something cycling related and raise money for Tutapona at the same time. And so finally, what ended up happening is I have a friend who runs an organization in Australia called You Belong, working with refugees there. And they just did, for World Refugee Week, an event called Bike to Belong, where he had people sign up to ride 80 kilometers in 8 days to benefit 80 million displaced people. It's the whole idea that right now on the planet, there's over 80 million people displaced from their home. This is the highest number ever in recorded history. And so playing off of that, he had this riding 80 kilometers in 8 days to benefit 80 million displaced. And so I started thinking about that, and I participated in that with him, and then started thinking, is there a way we could do something similar to that? What if we did something big and grand, like riding across the United States? And so I started thinking, could we have 8 riders make it in 8 days across the United States to benefit 80 million displaced people? Of course, I looked at what's the shortest route across the United States, and the Southern Tier route is the shortest, giving us the best chance to make it in 8 days. And so I started calculating almost 3,200 miles in 8 days, or 192 hours. If we average 16 miles an hour, we could do it. So I thought, that's doable. We can do that. It's not necessarily easy. It's a challenge, but I think it's a doable challenge. So it gives us something to train for. And so we've been training and working on that. And we've got 8 guys. We'll start in San Diego, California on October 2nd at 11 a.m. And we hope to make it in 192 hours to St. Augustine, Florida. We'll have one rider go at a time. Of course, all 8 of us will start from the Pacific Ocean so we can, you know, get a photo op and things. But then one rider at a time going for 2 hours, and then we'll switch. We'll have 2 support vehicles. One is an RV so that the riders can sleep. And then one's an SUV that will be able to follow behind the riders in the middle of the night when we're out in the middle of nowhere to make sure that they're safe on the road. But yeah, it's coming up now pretty quick, and we're getting excited about it. And I just got back from a training ride. I'm glad you're not video recording me, because I'm sure I've still got helmet hair going and all kinds of stuff. But I'm trying to train and ride hard every day for months now. And I think the team is getting ready. And right now I'm just excited to get there and get going.
I guess. So have you already raised some funds with the ride?
We have, that's right. Yep. We have a goal of raising $80,000. And right now we're over 45,000. So we're getting there.
You're more than halfway. That's pretty good.
Yeah. So we tasked each of the eight riders to raise $5,000 in sponsorship. So if the eight riders, you know, raise 5,000, that's 40,000 right there. And then we tried to get a few corporate sponsors, and this is our first attempt at this. My hope is that we'll be able to do this annually, and that it will grow and it'll get bigger each year, and we'll raise more awareness and more resources. But this is our first go, and it's going pretty good so far.
It sounds like it. Well, I really appreciate you contacting me about it, because these are the kinds of events that, you know, my listeners, many of them have done events like Ride Across America, you know, raising funds for cancer and for diabetes. So they are used to these kinds of events. But I would have to say that right now, looking at the worldwide situation and how many horrible things are happening, 80 million people are a lot of people to be displaced from their homes. And it's a tragic situation, and one that I think it's a good idea to highlight it. And this is a good way to do it. I'm really glad you're doing it.
Well, thank you, Diane. I appreciate that. I'm really hoping that it's a success. I'm hoping that we can get some good news coverage across the country, be in print media, radio, news. We're trying to set some of that stuff up. We're just really looking forward to raising awareness about this situation.
So here's what you need to do. Give my listeners the way they can get involved.
So yeah, you can go to our website, rideforrefugees.com. And there's information there. We'd love to have you donate. Some of the riders are still looking for some help raising funds, or you can just give generally to Ride for Refugees. All of the money will go to Tutapona for the work of providing emotional healing and restoration for people affected by armed conflict.
Well, Tutapona's website is very compelling all by itself. You know, you log on and the first thing you see, interestingly enough, the first picture that comes up for me, it looks like a man and his son with big smiles on their faces, which you want to see from these people, because I'm sure their lives in many ways have been so disrupted and are so miserable. So I really appreciate you talking with me again. We've been speaking with Carl Gady. He is the founder of Tutapona. It's Ride for Refugees. And we'll be watching it. I assume that up on that website, the Ride for Refugees website, there's an itinerary, so people will know if you're going through their communities. Can they hop onto your ride for a few hours?
Oh, we would love that. I'd love to connect with people along the way. People can even, you know, contact me. When I'm not riding, I'll be in a support vehicle, and I can be driven to places to even just meet with people, to answer questions, talk more about it. I think we're working on getting a live tracker on the website as well, so people can see right where we are. But we're following the Southern Tier route from San Diego to St. Augustine, Florida.
Okay. Well, thank you again for talking with me. Good luck with the ride, and we will keep track of it ourselves. When you're all finished, I'd love to check in with you for just a few minutes again to see how it went.
That sounds great. Thanks, Diane.
Thanks. You have a great day and a very successful, safe ride.
All right. Thank you so much.
My thanks to Carl Gady for joining me today. If you are interested in Tutapona and the work that Carl and Julie are doing, you can log on to tutapona.com. And if you want to donate, follow, or even hop on the upcoming cycling event beginning on October 2nd, you can log on to ride4refugees.com. My thanks again to Noah Banion, who, in addition to the unpacking of the bills in Congress, also reminds us that we have this uniquely suited moment of what she calls wild demand for safe and connected places to bike. Please take a moment to call, email, write your legislators, and shout out on your social media channels that you want to see the transportation and reconciliation bills passed, with all of the bicycle pieces intact. Of course, my thanks to you for listening. Please remember to join the conversations on our Facebook page. Follow us on Instagram at Outspoken Cyclist, which apparently you cannot do from our website. It still goes to my personal Instagram page, but we're working on it. And do visit our website, OutspokenCyclist.com, where every episode is available for download, along with notes, links, and photos. Next week, join me when I speak with Dr. Marlon Lee Moncrief. His new book, Black Champions in Cycling, was just published by RAFA, and it came out to much acclaim. We'll also have an update with Rob DeMartini from USA Cycling on the first meeting of the Inclusion Conference Series. A quick update, as promised, on the women's Afghan cycling team. I know I promised an update on the Afghan women's cycling team members. There are many plans in the works to evacuate the remaining women and some of their family members. The situation is still very dicey, and it's fluid. Some things are falling into place. Other things are still big question marks. If you are able, please help support the evacuation efforts. The choices for these women are becoming more clear. Leave the country and ride, stay, and perhaps never ride again. Go to fundly.com/support-afghan-cyclists. And as more stories, interviews, and information becomes available, you can find a compilation at OutspokenCyclist.com. Click the tab at the top of the page. Thank you once again for listening. I hope you have a great week. Please stay safe, stay well, and remember, there is always time for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We welcome your thoughts and contributions on our Facebook page, or visit OutspokenCyclist.com to leave a comment on any episode. We will be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast app and you'll never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.